A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is supported by the listener members of the Classical Network. Become a member today at wwfm.org. Thank you.
Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll mark the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I with a look at how this momentous event is being remembered in the classical music world. A Veterans Day concert at Carnegie Hall will present the U.S. premieres of works by composers Paul Miller and Patrick Hawes, and I'll speak with both of the composers. I'll also chat with Ryan James Brando, Artistic Director of the Monmouth Civic Chorus, and Larry Kursar, conductor of the Hunterdon Symphony, both of which are also performing Veterans Day concerts that reflect on the war and those who served. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Longtime supporter of the Curtis Institute of Music, A. Margaret Bach, passed away last month at the age of 98. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, Bach, who was daughter-in-law of Curtis founder Mary Louise Curtis Bach, helped move the school to adopt a more open approach and guided the school during a leadership crisis in the mid-80s. Bach served on the Institute's board in various capacities and endowed the school's A. Margaret Bach Chair in Double Bass Studies and the Mrs. Carey William Bach Fellowship. She received an honorary degree from Curtis in 1983. According to the Inquirer, a memorial will be held Sunday, November 18th in Northport, Maine. The music world also lost composer Francis Lai, who wrote the iconic theme song from the 1970 movie Love Story. According to the BBC, the French composer, who also composed the music for the film A Man and a Woman, passed away at the age of 86. Born in Nice, Lai won the Oscar for Best Original Score for Love Story, which included the song Where Do I Begin? Lai passed away November 7th. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. As word spread across the world of the armistice ending World War I on November 11, 1918, chimes rang out in many communities across the U.S. and Europe in celebration of the conclusion of 4 years of hostility that had ravaged the countryside and stolen millions of lives of both soldiers and civilians alike. The chiming of bells will play a key role in marking the 100th anniversary of the armistice, and many ensembles and artists have also chosen to mark this event with their own special musical performances and concerts as well, including several planned for November 11th, marked as Veterans Day here and Armistice Day in Europe. Carnegie Hall will feature the U.S. premieres of two new compositions on Veterans Day, Patrick Hawes' Great War Symphony, which debuted at London's Royal Albert Hall last month, and Paul Miller's Requiem, The Souls of the Righteous, which was first performed in September at St. Mary's Episcopal Church in Edinburgh. You just heard an excerpt from Hawes' symphony. The concert is being organized by Distinguished Concerts International New York, which is bringing together nearly 20 choirs from around the U.S. and beyond. I caught up with the composers earlier this week to ask them about the works, and also about what moved them to commemorate such a momentous historic period as World War I. Hawes said he had already been thinking about writing such a work before he received the commission from the U.K. Department of Defense that provided him with that opportunity.
I've always believed that the centenary of the First World War should give rise to monumental works of art, so that in 100 years' time for the second centenary, people can look back and say, well, what did they do 100 years ago? What did they bequeath us? And for me, I was kind of guided by Mahler's phrase that the symphony is a world. And I thought, well, if that's good enough for Mahler, that's good enough for me. So I'm going to use the genre of the symphony and write a choral work with soloists and symphonic accompaniment. to do with the First World War. And I thought this worked well, partly because there were 4 years of the First World War, and also, of course, the traditional symphony is in four movements. My inspiration came from a variety of sources. As a child, I knew my maternal grandfather very well, Bert, who survived the First World War. He was deaf and had a finger missing, you know, the scars of war. But he was very open about his experiences and used to sing to me World War One songs, like Tipperary, It's a Long Way to Tipperary. That one and the other one that sticks in my mind from my childhood is Mademoiselle from Armatier's Parley, that one. And then, as I say, I spent a long time researching the texts I was going to use, and my inspiration came from many different sources.
And if you could walk us through the four movements of each. There's the preludium, the march, the elegy, and the finale.
In order to give the symphony proper musical structure, I thought that each of the four movements should have an identity. And it took me quite a while, actually, to come up with these titles. Preludium is obviously a prelude, but I liked the German use of the word. It sort of feels a bit more serious, if you know what I mean. It is as well, of course, the Latin word for prelude. And it is just what it says. It depicts the outbreak of war. The very first words of the set are from Wilfred Owen's poem, 1914. And the words are, "War broke, and perishing great darkness closes in." That movement takes us through the Oath of Allegiance, the initial movement towards the continent, and the first stages of the conflict. The second movement, March, if there's going to be a symphony about a war, it's got to involve march rhythms and march percussion and just, you know, the military style. And the second year of the war was the year that saw most movement, not just on the front in France, but throughout the world, such as Gallipoli, the Turkish peninsula, and so on. And so the second movement has quite a lot of movement. I deal with Gallipoli. I deal with the Battle of Jutland at sea, the war at sea. It actually ends with the beginning of the Battle of the Somme, and I use as a text Siegfried Sassoon's diary entry from the first day of the Battle of the Somme, when he tells us about all hell being let loose. The third year of the war, I've called my third movement Elegy, was the year of the war when very little ground was made between the Germans and the Allies. You know, one of the sides would make a few hundred yards progress, and within the next few months they'd lost it again, which is a devastating loss. And I thought this was the good time just to dwell on the pain and the loss of war and the sadness of it all. And then the fourth movement, at finale, of course, sees the final year of the war, beginning with the Dies Irae text from the Requiem, which speaks of a kind of a stalemate, a deadlock between one world and the next, in this case, between one side and the next. And then the gradual appearance of light and a sense of things coming to an end, thankfully on the side of the Allies. I had actually introduced America in the third movement with words from a beautiful poem. I can't quite remember the poet offhand, but the poem's called America Speaks. But back to the fourth movement, there's a great moment in a poem by the English poet Thomas Hardy, who wrote a poem about the Armistice Day. It's called On Armistice, 1918, 11th of November. And a great, just two lines, calm fell, and from heaven distilled a clemency. I just loved that. I thought it was so poetic and musical. Anyway, towards the end of the work then, it almost becomes an act of remembrance. I set the last post with the iconic words of Laurence Binyon: "They shall grow not old as we, the left, grow old. Age shall not weary them." You know, the very famous words. And then the final poem I set, right at the end of the symphony, is by a female American poet, Moina Michael, "We Shall Keep the Faith." Fantastically optimistic poem. And it's interesting, it's the first time that anybody ever mentions the poppy as an emblem of remembrance. I don't know if you knew that, and the importance that this American lady played.
And now, this did premiere last month at Royal Albert Hall. What was the reception like there?
Oh, it was just the most amazing evening. It was hosted by Classic FM in the UK, which is a huge radio station. We had 4,000 in the audience. And we had the National Youth Choir of Great Britain, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. We beamed in youth choirs. We beamed into the hall as pre-records, choirs from Scotland, Ireland and Wales. And then I actually added parts for brass band, military band, and we had the band of the household cavalry as well. So it was huge, with 300 performers, and it was quite epic, really. And I was thrilled, of course, because it was the acid test of this work, but it really did seem to move people, and there's been a terrific response.
Are you approaching the US premiere of the work any differently?
Slightly differently, yeah. And from the outset, I must praise the work of DCINY for having this great vision of drawing choirs from around the world who come as a kind of package holiday, almost working holiday, to New York. And we have 250 singers, which is more than we had in the Royal Albert Hall. And I love the fact that we have choirs from Germany as well as America and Canada and, of course, the UK. And I feel that in itself is a very healing message for us as we celebrate, or at least mark, the 100th year since Armistice Day. So it's a much bigger choir. DCINY have formed an orchestra of players they know well and respect. And we have two American soloists. But it's going to have a different feel. And the Albert Hall is a different concert hall from Carnegie. I mean, I feel Carnegie is a proper classical concert hall, and it has a certain sort of gravitas to it. Whereas the Albert Hall can hold boxing matches and tennis matches, you know what I mean? It's kind of multi-purpose. But I think, in other words, there's something very special about it coming to be sung in Carnegie. I think it gives it an extra kind of seriousness, if that's the right word. And I'm so excited to be performing.
You've been commissioned throughout the past several years as the world has been commemorating the Great War, both from beginning through now to the end. What have you felt your role is as a composer in participating in this very public event?
Well, I feel my role has been, as I said at the beginning of this interview, was to musically create something monumental. I think that's very important. And in writing this large work, I feel I have had to distill each year of the war, which was no mean task. And it meant, actually, I spent 18 months just researching texts, poems, memorials, diaries, letters. But obviously through doing this, I feel I have come to really understand what remembrance of war is all about, particularly in terms of the First World War. And it's very easy for us to become quite passive about it, and maybe we feel we should attend the remembrance ceremony, but we can maybe stand at the back and observe in a passive way. But what I've realized is that we should all, you know, make an effort to remember, a conscious effort, subjective effort. Maybe that means going to the internet and looking up our name on the War Graves Commission website, where we can see if distant members of our own family were there. But more important than all this, I think this work has come to show why millions of human beings, mainly men, died. The answer to that vital, vital question at this time of remembrance is given to us by the poet Rupert Brooke in the poem Blow Out Ye Bugles, which occurs towards the end of the symphony. And this is so important. He says to us that what the dead bequeath to those of us who live, not only of the generation of the war, but subsequent generations, so us, he said that as a result of their sacrifice, they bought us holiness. Holiness lacked so long, he said, and love and pain and honour is come back as a king to earth. And nobleness walks in our ways again because of the sacrifice that was made. Now that, I think, is in a nutshell why remembrance is so important and why I feel my Great War Symphony can communicate something deep and hopefully everlasting about this vital centenary of the First World War.
That was composer Patrick Hawes, whose Great War Symphony will receive its U.S. debut on Veterans Day at Carnegie Hall. You can find his website at patrickhawes.com, and his last name is spelled H-A-W-E-S. Also on the program is Requiem, The Souls of the Righteous by Paul Miller. He said the work grew in part out of some previous works he had done for other armed services causes.
I wrote a piece for the Military Wives Choir and became associated with them, which was an organization in the UK, and now across the whole world. In fact, there's a US Military Wives Choir as well, which celebrated the community that is those people that give their all, really, in defense of freedom. And so I've been involved with that for a long time. And so when the opportunity came to, the honor came to write a piece to commemorate those who sacrificed all, I was delighted to be able to take part in that.
What were some of the things that you drew from for inspiration?
Well, the first thing I decided is I didn't want it to be a glorification of war. It had to be, for me, a glorification of peace. But I also wanted to honor the sacrifice of people who not only gave, their lives, which of course is one of the most important things anybody can do, as Jesus says, greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends, but also those who lost family members on both sides of the war. And so there's a movement in this new piece, which is called The Hand That Held the Knife, which talks about the one that holds the knife, but also the one that is scarred. So both are hurt by the act of war.
The work you wrote is a requiem. How did you work with the form of a requiem and bring these different ideas and concepts in to make it your own?
Well, yeah, the idea that I had originally was that we would look at the soul, human soul, and the souls of the righteous. And there's this wonderful line in the Bible where it says, the souls of the righteous are in the hands of God. And so the question came, who are the righteous? What does it mean? And so I have a wonderful librettist that I work with a lot called Graham Davis. In fact, Graham's coming up for the weekend to be here for the performance. He's a phenomenal prize-winning poet in Wales, perhaps Wales' greatest poet. And the two of us sat down and started discussing what is this aspect of righteous. And so we decided a structure between us that there would be the proper requiem parts of the Mass that are essential to the Mass, the Kyrie, the Sanctus, the Benedictus, the Agnus Dei, all those movements that are really important to represent a funeral mass. But then there would be reflections upon those movements in English, so not in Latin, which would actually go deeper into the idea of what is righteousness. So that's how we began to structure it. So we ended up with 10 movements that look at each aspect of what it means to be righteous. And so one of the movements, of course, is Jesus' own view on what righteousness is, which are the Beatitudes. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall, and blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. So he actually talks about what righteousness is in his Sermon on the Mount. So that's included as the second movement.
Well, this premiered in September. What was the premiere like? What was the reception like?
Well, with any new piece, you never quite know. When you write a piece, you don't fully hear it until everyone gets together. And so the reception was fantastic. We sold out, and it was recorded live for radio in the UK. And in the UK, it's very unusual to get standing ovations. It just doesn't happen in the UK. I don't know what it is. It's part of our pompousness, I suppose. But they got one. So and it's very unusual to get a standing ovation for a requiem, because it's a solemn piece. And so it was wonderful that we had Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall, Camilla, who came to attend that, which was a great honour for me and for the performers. And it's since, after this weekend's performance, there are a whole host of performances, about 15 lined up all across the world, which I think is a testament to how people feel about this subject itself.
And it will be having its U.S. Debut this weekend at Carnegie Hall. Are you anticipating different receptions as you go through from Carnegie Hall and then throughout other locations across the world? Are you setting things up any differently as you go?
No, I think the piece and the words and the music speaks for themselves, and they affect people in very different ways. Some people who are strongly anti-war needn't be afraid of this piece, because itself anti-war in a strange way. It's celebrating peace, it's celebrating sacrifice, which are at the hearts of almost all faith, any faiths really. So I think it will get different reactions wherever it is done, but I'm hoping that they will be positive and also reflective upon what the subject matter is.
And how do you see your role as a composer, as a member of the musical artistic community, in approaching themes and issues and topics of this great importance, but also, as you said, with all the differing opinions and the context that we are in now?
That's right. I mean, the world is constantly changing, and music does not exist in a vacuum. It is both a mirror and a light to the mirror. You know, it reflects, and also it reflects upon it. I've been reading Dante recently, in which he talks about three different circles all reflecting upon each other. And so that's the interesting thing about art, that it must in some way communicate what's happening now as well as timeless things. And so in this piece, we do talk about reconciliation and the fact that one can't always feel anger to what was once one's enemy. One must really embrace it. And I think it doesn't matter what time or what place or wherever you are, that is one of the most beautiful things that there is. You know, I've lived in various parts of the world, and I've seen conflict, and I've seen the beauty of peace that has happened in that. And I think when that happens, it is the most magical thing. A composer has to be part of society. In Benjamin Britten, I think the English composer spoke very eloquently about how we must not just sit in an ivory tower, we actually have to engage with society. And I think today is one of the most exciting times to be alive as a composer. And also daunting, because you know, you want to try and say something that is going to be of use and importance to people.
That was my conversation with composer Paul Mueller. His Requiem, The Souls of the Righteous, will also be performed at the November 11th concert at Carnegie Hall, presented by Distinguished Concerts International New York. You can find Mueller's website at paulmueller.com. His last name is spelled M-E-A-L-O-R. More information is available at carnegiehall.com or dciny.org. Among other musical programs on November 11th are a concert by the Monmouth Civic Chorus that includes Rayfon Williams' Dona Nobis Pacem in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, and a concert by the Hunterdon Symphony at Hunterdon Central High School in Flemington, New Jersey, featuring works by composers who served in World War I. I spoke with Ryan Brando, Artistic Director of Monmouth Civic Chorus, and Larry Kursar, Conductor of the Hunterdon Symphony, about including such a program in their seasons this year. Kursar started off.
As a community orchestra, we always try to do things to promote our community. So this was something that is coming up, and we have a local historian who's going to be speaking about things that affected Hunterdon County and the surrounding areas, as well as the music.
And Ryan?
Well, for us, it was really a musical opportunity. Anytime we have an anniversary, you know, particularly a centenary like this, you can't help but to mark it in some way and think, how are things the same now? How are things different now? And for me, what I found most interesting was that there are some pieces out there for chorus and orchestra that tell the story, as much as there is a singular story, of something like the First World War through personal reflection. And it's just like an apt opportunity to reconnect to 100 years ago through just the words of individuals from that time and from all times of war. So it really was an artistic inclination, I think, that led us to mark this centenary. And then that was combined with the fact that in Monmouth County, which is where Monmouth Civic Chorus is, there is an Army base, Fort Monmouth, that was taken offline in 2005, but is still there and is still a part of the community. And there's a space there that we were interested in performing in. And that all just seemed to come together at the same time, that we could do a piece that was based on text from times of war at the 100th anniversary of the armistice and do it on what was for many decades an Army base. It all kind of came together.
So it was interesting for us from the programming thing that when we were looking into it, we were surprised to see how many composers were actually in the armed forces in World War I. And so we designed the program around those composers. So Holst, Vaughan Williams, Ravel, Coles, Still, they all served in the services. And we put the program around them.
Well, you both touched on this slightly, but I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on how a program like this illustrates the role that you see your ensemble playing in the community
what is your role as artists in this?
Well, I think it's not my place as a leader of a community arts organization to be prescriptive or to even be political. And I was drawn to the Moravec that we're doing in particular because Moravec said about the piece, he said it's not especially pro-war nor anti-war, but concerns expressions of love by individuals facing extreme conditions. He said that the texts convey admirable courage in the face of extraordinary suffering. And I think that that's where our art form, music, it can speak for us when we don't necessarily have any words, when we can't put the words together. And I think that's what we're trying to offer with this program this coming weekend, is just we're not trying to comment on World War I and that 100-year anniversary or any of the other conflicts that are touched upon in the text that we're singing, but just to offer a place for reflection and a place to consider the impact of those conflicts and what that might be. And I think that's very much how Monmouth Civic Chorus functions in Monmouth County. We have, for instance, a much-loved holiday concert that's an opportunity just for people to come together and feel celebratory and feel uplifted as a community. This was an opportunity this November for us to do so in a way that reached out to the veteran community in Monmouth County and just offer a place to bring people together to hear the same words, set to the same music, and take their own reflections and reactions away from that.
Well, you know, the mission of our orchestra is to serve the community, and that includes the audience and also the members of the orchestra. And so we always are looking to incorporate events with our orchestra, with communities. So this is a milestone date that we felt that we should try to put together a theme. And we added the historian. We have the local high school and middle school choir joining us for the singing of Jerusalem, which in England has almost become their national anthem. It was sung right at near the end of the war, and it's a very moving piece. So we try to involve a lot of people in our group and the outside group organizations.
That was my conversation with Larry Kursar, which is performing a concert November 11th at 3 p.m. at 100 Central High School, and Ryan Brando, Artistic Director of Monmouth Civic Chorus, whose concert that day at Fort Monmouth is sold out. More information on the concerts and the ensembles can be found at 100inmusicalarts.org and monmouthciviccorus.org. You can hear additional comments from my guests on the Odd Tempo page of our website at wwfm.org. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.